Good morning. Okay, we are in Daniel, so we'll turn on over there. I have one picture left. If you took one and stuffed it in your Bible, now is the time to pull it back out and to let it continue cruising around. Okay. So we're in chapter 2. Whew. We already found one more. Okay, recap from what we've covered so far in chapter 2. Nebuchadnezzar has had a dream. God gives Daniel the dream and its interpretation. And in the beginning of chapter 2, Daniel has begun telling King Nebuchadnezzar the dream. And that's as far as we... that's as far as we made it, basically, through verse 35. Okay, some things that we talked about. the summer threshing floor is the process of harvesting the grain head from the wheat. That is done by cutting the wheat into stalks and then throwing them on the ground. That would be the floor, the threshing floor. when it's dried out, they would take a winnowing fork, and then with the winnowing fork, or what we would call a pitchfork, they would throw it up into the air. And because it's dry and brittle, the chaff, the stemmy part of the wheat plant, particularly the part that's covering the grain head, would shatter and kind of fall, blow away with the breeze, and then the heavier wheat head would remain, and it would fall straight back down, and that's how they would separate the chaff from the grain head. So it always makes me very appreciative for modern machinery. It's amazing to me at the efficiency rate that these combines can do this, you know, and it's just, and you can see it just chucking the chaff right out the back, you know, and kind of even fanning it out so that way it covers the ground pretty equally so that it breaks down more evenly and quicker. Anyway, so that comes up here, so we understand those terms. Typically speaking, the scripture speaks negative of chaff, so you do not want to be chaff. Okay, John the Baptist in the Gospel of Matthew says, in referring to Jesus, that Jesus has a winnowing fork in his hand. Okay, so now you can picture Jesus with the fork, and he's got the pile of, you know, wheat down there, and says he's going to clear his threshing floor, and as for the chaff, he is going to burn in fire. All right. So we want to be the wheat. We want to be the grain. We do not want to be the chaff. The Bible usually uses chaff as a reference to judgment. Judgment specifically on those who don't make it to heaven. So, all right. Then we've got a statue and a stone. The two main images in this dream. What do the different layers of metal represent in the statue? Cool. Kingdoms. Okay. What do you notice about the metals? Yeah, so it's descending in value. You've got gold, which would be a lot more valuable than silver. Silver more than bronze. Bronze more than iron. Each having its own purpose and certainly useful and necessary, but in value. I mean, even to this day, I mean, you can, you know, I mean, I don't know. You're going to find more gold jewelry in the store than you are bronze jewelry, right? Not that you don't have any on or that you can't find bronze jewelry, but gold is by far, you know, even today considered more valuable. Why is the rock or the stone cut out of the mountain without hands? What? Representation of Jesus? Well, Jesus is the rock, right? He's cut out of the mountain without hands. So that means without human agency, meaning God did it. If we look at verse 44 here in Daniel chapter 2, that'll confirm it for us. It says, in the days of those kings, so the metal represents those kings and their kingdoms. He says, in those days, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom. Okay? So verse 44 confirms for us that that rock that's coming was done by God. And the way that that's communicated in the dream is that it was cut out without human hands, which is very important because isn't that what Colossians says about our immersion, right? He says, you know, in your immersion, you underwent a circumcision made without hands in the removing of the body of flesh. That lets us know then that immersion is not just a physical outward sign. Okay? Colossians tells us that there actually is a spiritual inward operation. Right? So actually the way that baptism is commonly taught in the denominational world is actually just in direct conflict with Colossians chapter 2. Because they're going to say it's an outward physical sign of something that's already taken place in the inner man, right? Where Colossians says, no, actually there's a spiritual operation taking place on the inside, okay? And then the second important part of that is who's doing the operation? God. Because it's not done with hands, which the Bible's consistent means not done by human agency. So you didn't save yourself in your baptism, and none of you thought you did. Okay? But that's a huge argument against baptism and its relationship and correlation to salvation, right? Is that, you know, you're trying to save yourself. You're trying to receive salvation by works, which the Bible's very clear is not possible. Okay? Who's doing the work? God, because Colossians says it's done without human agency, without hands. Okay, and then I kind of already said it. What does the stone represent in the dream? It's Jesus, right? And then when the stone hits the statue and then grows into a mountain that covers the whole earth, what is that? That's the church, right? So that was last week. If none of that made sense, he missed last week, okay? Don't want to spend too much more time on that. Verse 36, Daniel chapter 2. This was the dream. Now we will tell its interpretation before the king. I sound really loud up here. Am I too loud for you guys? Good? Okay. You, O king, are the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them. You are the head of gold. After you, there will arise another kingdom inferior to you, then another third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over all the earth. Then there will be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things. So like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. In that you saw the feet and toes partly of potter's clay, partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom, but it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with common clay. As the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and a part of it will be brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with the common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. And that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. Okay? So if you are not familiar with this dream in Daniel, there is a picture floating around here. I don't know if it's made its way back to Shereed yet, but I think it was kind of going down this way. Super helpful for kind of understanding, okay, what was it that Nebuchadnezzar saw here and what Daniel is explaining. a couple quick thoughts here before we kind of start to break this down. There are a couple things that jump out to me here, aside from the obvious. Right out of the gate, in verse 37, he says, "You, O king, are King of kings, to whom God, the God of heaven, has given the kingdom, power, strength, and glory, and wherever the sons of men dwell, the beasts of the field, or birds of the sky, he has given them in your hand and has caused you to rule over them. You are the head of gold." Now, this might be a small thing, but I'm not used to the Bible referring to worldly kings in this way with such support from God. Okay, but I believe that that is for a reason. Okay? Now, clearly, Nebuchadnezzar is the king that's alive and ruling when the dream is given. So God doesn't go into a ton of detail about the king after him and that God gave him his power, because Cyrus will go on to say the very same thing. "I was raised by God for this purpose." Even Cyrus understood God's role in him coming to power. But the first thing that we should notice is that the interpretation of the dream is very clear that Nebuchadnezzar is in power because God has given him that power. Now, that's true of any king. No king rises, falls. No kingdom rises and falls without God allowing it. Okay? But this is special and unique. Look at this. He says, God has given you the kingdom and God has given you power, strength, and glory. That's why he's the head of gold. That's the first point I want to make. Because we have to figure out why these are descending in order of value. We've identified that they're descending in order of value, but why? Okay, Nebuchadnezzar is the head of gold, and he's the gold because God put him there, and God has given him everything that he has. Okay, the second thing that jumps out to me, other than the obvious, is when you get down to verse 40, we've got kingdom, succeeding kingdom, and a little bit of information about the kingdom. One kingdom's inferior, okay? And in verse 40, it says, "Then there will be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things." And that is exactly what iron does. We'll come to that later. "So like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces." So that's unique to the iron that's not there for the silver and for the bronze. He introduces the silver and he introduces the bronze and he gives us a little bit of detail about them. But when he introduces the iron, he makes special emphasis on the fact that iron can crush everything else and that it did. Right? Now, there is a stone coming that's going to crush everything. Right? But the way that this is being laid out is it's communicating. We've got the head of gold. Powerful in influence, duration of time, given power, glory, and strength by God. And by the time we get to the iron, it does recognize the strength that was in that empire. Okay? So let's talk about this for a minute. The head of gold represents the kingdom of Babylon. Okay? And our God is good. Amen? Have you ever thought more into why these kingdoms were represented by the metals that they were? Here's what I'm trying to say. It's enough for me that God can predict the number of world kingdoms between two set dates and get it right. How about you? That's enough for me. Okay? You've got roughly a span of, 600 years of history from the time that the dream is given. Because you can also think of the statue as like a timeline, right? So the head is current day, and then as you go down the statue, you're going down the timeline, right? So it's about, 600 years from the top of the statue to when Jesus comes. Right? And in that time period, God is predicting the exact number of kingdoms that would rise and fall. That's incredible. Let's take our shot. 600 years from now is year what? 26 something? All right. How many kingdoms? Let's go, Josh Gull. Oh, yeah. That's the kicker, right? All right, Josh Gull, let's go. How many kingdoms for the next 600 years? How many empires are going to rise and fall? Pat, you got a thought? How do we know? Six? Can I get seven? Seven, go on eight. Eight. Wait, can mankind do that? And then Jared says the kicker of all. How do you know the whole thing just doesn't end tomorrow? And we kind of live in an interesting time because who's the world power today? China. It's not America. That's where we're headed, for sure, right? You still got nations, you know, smacking each other right now a little bit. But yeah, this is the stuff that proves to me that God authored this book. Man, how do you prove God wrote the Bible? You do it by proving mankind couldn't have. What can mankind not do? Predict with accuracy the exact number of kingdoms that would rise and fall in, you know, roughly a 600-year period. Does God stop there, though? Nope. He just keeps putting little seeds of detail in there for the one who desires to know the truth. Okay? All right. Head of gold, not a hard one to prophesy because that represents the kingdom of Babylon. And in that day that this interpretation was being given, Babylon was the kingdom. Okay? So gold, I mean Babylon, I mean, what's Babylon known for historically? Hanging gardens, right? What did you say, Kevin? Tower of Babel, right? How does the New Testament use Babylon in its representation? World culture, right? And what about world culture? It's alluring and enticing because it has shiny things and desirous things, okay? Gold is a very fitting representation of Babylon because Babylon was very rich, okay? Even do some reading and you kind of hear about how Alexander the Great fell in love with Babylon by the time he made it there, right? And didn't want to leave. I wonder why. Like, it was not only valuable in its wealth, but I mean, it was, okay, that's what it represents, is its tremendous value, its alluring, and its value through its alluring riches, okay? Then we get to the next section, which conveniently has two arms, right, coming together, and this is the kingdom that comes after Babylon. What does the arms and chest of silver represent? The Medes and the Persians, right? So, the one thing that Daniel said here is that it would be an inferior kingdom, right? So, you've got the Medes and the Persians coming together to form a joint power that would go on to replace Babylon. Now, if you've read Daniel, does Babylon get replaced by the Medo-Persian Empire because it was weaker than the Medo-Persian Empire? I'm thinking specifically of Daniel chapter 5. What was the downfall of Babylon? It wasn't because it was inferior to the Medo-Persian Empire that destroyed it. What happened to Babylon? Yeah, complete. So you've got this beginning. This is what I want you guys to see. You've got this beginning where it's very clear. Nebuchadnezzar, you are there because of God. And he's already saying these things to Daniel, like your God is the one God, right? And he doesn't stop there. But then by the end of it, the whole nation and its king has turned away from God. What do you think is going to happen to the kingdoms after it? Do you think Persia walks around calling on the strength and power of the God, the creator of the world? You think Greece, what does Greece worship? The God of the Bible? No, it worshiped Alexander the Great. What? It's like, at least the Persians thought their king was a god, right? By the time you get to the Greeks, like they're not even worshiping. I mean, they're just worshiping people. And then you get to Rome and it's just like, you have the people and the Senate and the king, and you just have a mess. Okay, and that's why they're descending in value. Because you've got kingdoms established and set by God, and then as they deteriorate, you have mankind relying on his own merit and will. Jared's got a comment here.
One of the things that I think is interesting with the decreasing value in that is that as they decrease in value, the kingdom sizes, the influence that they have increases. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Babylon's a relatively small compared to the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire was smaller than the Greek Empire, and obviously you follow that logic through. And so it was just the commonality of it, I think, is interesting in that, you know, iron is very common, much more so than gold. And so I've always found it interesting that as they decrease in value, they increase in size and move further and further and further away from God.
Yeah, I appreciate that because, you know, again, just predicting four is enough for me, and God just keeps throwing these little things in here, right?
I just think it perfected more and more. They perfected more and more going down. By the time they got to Rome,
we have to wait. I'm just really excited for that part. But Mr. Taylor's a sharp guy. He said, as you go further and further down the statue, they perfected more and more in war. Yeah, we're coming back to that. Okay. Babylon didn't get replaced by the Medo-Persian Empire because it lost due to its strength. It lost because it had turned away from God and was resting on its own laurels. What happens in Daniel, and I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but in Daniel 5, the last standing king of Babylon is just partying all the time. And he goes and gets the vessels that were taken out of the temple of God, the gold vessels, you know, and just starts dumping wine in them. And everybody's hammered. And that's the night that the Persians come in and wipe them out. Okay? So they didn't lose because Persia's army was greater, its commanders were greater, or its king was, you know, smarter. Okay, they lost because they had turned into self and were basically basking in their own glory. We'll get to that down the road. So Persia is referred to as the inferior kingdom. That's my take on that. Babylon didn't fall because it was weaker. Then Persia, but because she was resting on her laurels. So now we get to bronze. What is bronze? What's the bronze kingdom? The Greeks, right? It does not. I mean, this is incredible to me. The Greek Empire historically is widely known for its bronze weaponry, for its bronze armor, and for its bronze art. I mean, they were known for that. But yet hundreds of years ahead of time, that's the metal that God chose to represent this kingdom. I do not think that was an accident. Okay, so that's primarily what Greece is known for historically. You know, okay, now we get to the fourth kingdom, which is iron. And that represents what? Ever heard of the Iron Roman army? Why? Why is it called the Iron Roman army? Because they were so tough? Better question for you. Is Rome historically known for its great commanders? Did Rome destroy people because its war generals were greater than the war generals that came before them? Nope. Do you know what Rome did that was the first in its day? Iron's been around forever, right? The Romans were the ones who figured out how to fashion iron into weapons. And they crushed everything they came in contact with. They got better at fighting. the Greeks, what empowered the Greek Empire in war? Its mighty general, didn't it? Okay. So you get to the Greeks. The Greeks were great in war because they had great generals. And in the beginning, a mighty, probably greatest general ever in Alexander the Great. You get to the Romans. The Romans were not powerful. The army was not successful because it had really awesome commanders and generals. Rome was the first nation to figure out how to fashion weapons out of iron. And then they went and crushed everything. And their kingdom grew because of it. And that's why they got better at fighting war, like Mr. Taylor is saying, because they just figured that out, right? And then as soon as you start building boats and making cannons and start building ships and airplanes, you see how that process continues on into this day. And now you can fight a war without people. Okay? I'm not even talking about the bank, because you could do that too. But I'm talking about you get your guy with his little Xbox controller in his hand, and he can fly a drone so high that no radar can see it, and it can drop bombs on people, man. So you've just seen how it's progressed. That's what. So, guys, what does this have to do with what we read? I said it earlier. They figured out how to take iron and put it into weapons. Iron's heavy. The Romans were the ones who figured out how to do that. And then they crushed everything in sight. Isn't that what Daniel just said? He said the fourth kingdom of iron will crush and put an end to all the kingdoms before it. That is why. So the detail in here is amazing. Yeah, let's read that in verse 40. There will be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron. These aren't arbitrary. God chose these for a reason. They represent their nation for a reason. He says, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things. Look, the people showing up with the iron weapons had a much better advantage because iron crushes everything else. He says, so like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. What's the these? It's the gold, silver, and the bronze. It's the nation that's coming before it, okay? At least until the stone drops on it. Okay, now we've got a little bit of a change here, because by the time you get to the feet, you have the feet still retaining iron. So what kingdom is it then? Rome. Do you realize how many people already get this wrong? It says that it's made of iron. Okay, because they want... Another day. Hey, when you get to the bottom, when the clay is mixing with the iron, it's telling you that in the latter parts of that empire, right, timeline, it starts to become brittle. Because pottery does not mix with iron. Okay, a lot of people in the world misinterpret this because there's toes on the feet. And they try to say, like, oh, this is referring to, like, another empire. Or, okay, this is actually referring to, we have to wait. You know, they're trying to count the number of kings since Jesus came. Right? And I don't know, like, are we going with the Russian king, the American king, the Canadian king? Like, who counts, who doesn't count? Like, they're really trying to count because they think the toes represents kings because they don't think that the kingdom has come yet. Do you see that? Now, we've talked about this quite a bit, so I hope that this adds value to what we're doing here and doesn't take away. Jesus established his kingdom, okay, primarily when he ascended to heaven, okay? Because he pours forth his spirit, and then his kingdom is the church. But most people, when they read the Old Testament particularly, they're reading it with a literal interpretation, and they are still waiting for Jesus' kingdom to come. So because they are still, and this is premillennialism, because they're still waiting for Jesus' kingdom to come, they don't think the rock has hit the statue yet. Do you see that? So now what they've got to do is they've got to figure out, how do we make sense of that? That's why you can't go into this with a false assumption. So they go into it trying to figure out, okay, the rock hasn't hit the statue yet. What are we going to do with the toes? So it's like, I know, we'll just say that the toes represent kings, even though this mentions nothing about that and has nothing to do with that. And when you read the rest of Daniel, we're going to see another section that has this, a similar type vision about these world powers, and it represents nothing about kings. Okay, so they're going to say, well, we have to wait for 10 kings to come, because hopefully that's how many toes were on this statue, and then the rock comes, the stone comes. Do you guys see that? Okay, well, they're missing, just from the picture of the statue itself, it's still iron. It tells you what kingdom the stone comes in at, right? It tells you it's iron. It didn't change. And then we have like three or four verses solely dedicated to the fact that iron and clay don't mix. How does that play out historically? I'll take someone, okay? In the latter days of Rome, the statue is saying it'll become brittle. How does that play itself out historically? And I'm asking. Roger's got a thought here.
Doesn't that play out? Because like in the last part of the Roman kingdom, they allowed like the Jews and so forth to rule themselves within a place. But within that, that became weak as far as their rule. Because think about it, you let your kids kind of rule in your own house, your house is going to become weak because they think that they have a power.
Yeah. I think it absolutely has to do with that. Okay. I thought I heard something.
It was an owl.
Yeah.
My view on it, how I take it with it being brittle, is Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon. So it went from kings to a republic to empire. And so when he crossed the Rubicon, and that's where, of course, we get the phrase from, is that there's no turning back. So effectively, Julius Caesar declared war, informally, formally, however you want to look at it, when he set the new course for Rome. And then it took a while to Constantine to fizzle out. And then a lot of people now, and rightly so, about how the Roman Catholic Church came. Yeah. But politically speaking, as a structure, are we going from, you know, king, republic, to empire? And then it definitely, all kinds of wild things happened after he did that.
Yeah.
And so he weakened that whole structure for money.
Mm-hmm. He had to get money. So I want to add on to this here for a second. So Rome is very unique in two ways, okay? Was Rome succeeded by another nation like all the nations before it in the statue? No. Did anybody destroy Rome? So where did Rome go? Did Rome? It became a church. Where's all the gold that the Empire of Rome had today? Say it out loud. Did you say it? I thought you said it. The Vatican. So where did the Roman Empire go? It wasn't beat by a Persian Empire or a France Empire or by a Canada Empire. It just turned into, it basically fell apart. We'll talk about why, which is really debated, actually. But we'll stick to the point of the vision here. But it didn't get conquered by another nation. It became a church. And its power and its influence and its money and its resources, they're all at the Vatican. All of it, okay? So, church, and then, you read about the power that church has and the fight it had with those European kings, man. It's like, that's where the power went, okay? I don't want to forget Jesus' trial here, so someone get me back there. But, yeah, Roger's point, Rome, the other thing that Rome did that's different than these other kingdoms is, you know, Persia comes in and it just kills everyone. Maybe save the women and the children because they can raise the children to be slaves and they can, you know, teach them their ways. But you speak their language, right? And you use their money. Okay? Nebuchadnezzar came in, destroyed the Jews and everybody, and then built himself a statue and said, you worship that. Right? The Persians come in and said, if we catch you worshiping God in prayer, you're going to get locked up. right? The Romans came along and they're like, oh, you can worship whatever you want. Oh, you can have your own money. You can have your own economic system. You can have your own priesthood. You can have your own king. What? You can have your own language. That's what the Romans did. Why did the Romans do that? Every nation before them just came and killed everyone and said, you take our currency, our gods, our language, our culture, you conform to us. And then the Romans were the first one to come along and say, you can keep all that. Why'd the Romans do that?
Didn't want to kill the golden goose.
Yeah. They did it for what, Mr. Taylor? For money. They said, hey, keep your gods, keep your currency, keep your language, keep your culture. You just pay taxes. So that's Roger's point, man. Was there a king of the... Now, please follow me along here. Who's king in the Roman Empire? Caesar? Didn't the Jews have a king? What was his name? His name was King Herod. Like, wait, think about this for a second. There were kings inside of other kings' kingdoms? There were. Now, who appointed the king of the Jews? The Romans. You know, because they got that all wrong, because Herod was Idumean. So they, you know, the Jews didn't approve of their own king. Let's just make sure that that's clear. Okay? And that came to really work against the Romans, because their kingdom was too big, like Jared said. It covered too much area, and it was broken into too many sections with too many influences and powers being scattered. So Jesus' trial is a really good illustration of this, right? When Shadrach and Benny wouldn't bow down to the statue, okay, my daughter was telling me this. Thank you for everyone who teaches Sunday school. And they're not here, so you just tell them I said that. It's funny. My daughter can't say half the words, but she can say Nebuchadnezzar, like, perfectly. It's hilarious. She kind of struggles with her tongue, and she comes in. Nebuchadnezzar is not good, Dad. He made a statue. Ask her to say Abednego. Okay, that one's a little trickier. Yeah, you know, Nebuchadnezzar comes in and he's like, you worship me. Right? So these guys won't bow down to the statue. What happens? They get ushered in front of the king. And then the king says, out with you. Into the fiery furnace of fiery affliction, right? Now, Jesus, accused of doing wrong. Where do they take him? To Caesar? Nope. Can't do that. Why? Because we got to go through the process. And first he goes to who? Who do they send Jesus to first? You got two different high priests there, so he kind of got a little bit of... Okay? But generally speaking, I would say before the Sanhedrin. You got the Sanhedrin, which was comprised of Pharisees and Sadducees and Herodians and chief priests. And okay, they kind of came together as the ruling class of the Jews underneath King Herod. So yeah, Jesus goes there. And they're like, yeah, you're guilty, you know. So did they order his execution? Nope. Why didn't they? Because they can't. The Jewish Sanhedrin is not allowed to order someone the death penalty. Only the Romans get to do that. It's still the Roman Empire. So then they send Jesus to Pilate, who is the Roman procurator, who could offer the death penalty. And then what does Pilate do? He gives him the death penalty and strings him up, right? Nope. Where does Pilate send him? Herod. Oh, no. Look, this is a Jewish matter. Go to your king. Go to your jurisdiction. You see how broken and divided this Roman kingdom is? So then Herod gets him. What's Herod do? He just sends him back to Pilate. And then that's the story that we're pretty familiar with the Gospels really, really in detail pick up that side of the crucifixion, because then Pilate has the interaction with his wife and with the crowds, and then finally his hand is forced, he feels like, and then he orders the execution. So Jesus's trial really is a kind of a little microcosm glimpse into the clay and the iron. Right? Was it not even a few years later that the iron Roman army rose up again and destroyed Jerusalem? Was the toughness of iron still in that kingdom? Yeah, it destroyed Jerusalem. Okay, it still had its iron weapons. Okay, but its kings are rising and falling, and there's drama, and senators are killing kings, and kings are killing senators, and you've got commanders rising, and they're being killed by their... I mean, it's a mess. That's the clay. And it's in those days God would set up a kingdom, right? It is a perfect picture of Rome in its last days.
Just one more quick historical tidbit. I think it was up until 24 AD, the Jews actually had the ability or had the power to put someone to death. I think it was up to 24 AD. So... almost like something happened in history that the Lord made sure and happened so that all of this would be exposed.
Oh, just another layer, right? That change was made just a few years before Jesus is on trial. Yep, exactly. So let's see where we're at here. Yeah, that's good. Let's go to Jeremiah chapter 27. Jeremiah chapter 27, verse 5. I have written above this chapter as my chapter heading, and it says, go to Babylon or die trying. Okay? Because again, what we talked about in the initial parts of this class is God told his people to go into Babylonian captivity willingly, because God knew that they would only spend a short time there, relatively, and that they would be allowed to go back to Jerusalem, and then there would be a lineage that could carry on to Jesus. So here is a section where the Lord is telling them, go to Babylon, don't fight this. If you fight this, you're going to die. And in verse 5, he says, I have made the earth, the men and the beasts which are on the face of the earth, by my great power and by my outstretched arm, I will give it to one who is pleasing in my sight. Now, I have given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, my servant. And I have given him all the wild animals of the field to serve him. All the nations shall serve him and his sons and his grandsons until the time of his own land comes. Then many nations and great kings will make him their servant. It will be that the nation or kingdom which will not serve him, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and which will not put their neck under the yoke of the king of Babylon, I will punish that nation with the sword, with famine, and with pestilence, declares the Lord, until I destroy it by his hand. So what you see here in this statue, this is a great place to wrap up, we'll come back here and finish up, is that the emphasis in the beginning is that Nebuchadnezzar's rule was seen as God-given. The further you go down, you see the degradation of the rule of man as it relies more on itself than it does giving any kind of recognition that it's there because of the one true creator God. Right? You get down. Okay. The Persians believed that their power, where did the Persians believe their power came from? The Persian was able to ascend to power because of nobility. They claimed that there were lines that were God-given by their gods, but that you ascended to the throne because of nobility. And that's not a novel thing, but that was unique to the Persians. So to even where the Persian king thought that he was a god, the people viewed him Lots of times they said the God King cannot bleed, they would say, in the Persian Empire. They believed that. So now we see Nebuchadnezzar established by God. Nebuchadnezzar, God's servant, put there and given power by God. You get one nation later and the king is already calling himself God. Deteriorating in value. Then you get to the bronze Greeks. What put Alexander in charge as being king? God? No. Nobility? No. What did you say, Jared?
He killed his dad.
Yeah. If you were the strongest and the most powerful, you were king in Greece. Strength. Strength was honored. Okay? So, how did the Romans put their... I mean, and we covered it. What put the... I mean, the Roman Caesar? Like, you could see how every layer we go, we are getting further and further away from God. I'm here because of God, and you're relying on the people and senates and power, and you got all sorts of stuff going on. So we're at the top of the hour, so we have to stop there, and we'll pick back up next week. Thanks, you guys.